They'll want your money, you know. That was the family's immediate reaction when he told them he'd joined a church. They'll want your money, you know. And the truth is, we've fed that cynical side of our natures with enough examples of church exploitations over the years that ministers become wary of speaking too plainly about passages like this one. Though the truth also is, of course, that the Lord wants far more than just your money. And as it was read, I suspect again, more than one of us thought that this pitch for their money was a bit kind of emotionally manipulative. And Paul is after their money, of course, but not for himself. He's collecting for brother and sister Christians caught up in a famine hundreds of miles away in Jerusalem. And emotional, well, certainly he'll tug at heartstrings as well as at head ropes, but there's no deceit involved. And for a day and age when charities raise money by, using human interest stories, pictures of starving children, this is very straightforward. It's just an appeal to let the facts of the cross evoke a response in the Corinthians like it had in their Macedonian brothers and sisters. So look carefully at what he's saying. It's as if he knows some of the kind of questions that will come into anyone's mind, and he wants to give them their answers. For example, what does love look like? Because, you see, Paul has turned this raising of money for the relief fund into a test of love. That's how he begins in verse 8, isn't it? I want to test the sincerity of your love. And a bit of us resents this mixing of talking about cash and a test of love. You know, for many of us, they belong in very different compartments. Love and emotions are kept over here. Cash and hard-nosed finance, very definitely over there. But Paul argues he can talk about love in verse 8, for, as he begins verse 9, you see, for you know what love is like, he says. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you through his poverty might become rich. What does love look like? Well, it looks like gospel generosity. Taking a truth we know and love and applying it to where we rarely go with it. Now, he's already written to the Corinthians explaining the significance of the cross just a few chapters back. Here's what he wrote in chapter 5 and verse 20. He wrote that God made him, that is Jesus, who had no sin, to be sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. And we read this verse, chapter 8, verse 9, worth having it there in front of you for a moment. We're going to compare the two. We read this verse rightly through the lens of that one. See, chapter 5, verse 20 says of Jesus, had no sin, and then came to be sin. He was rich, became poor. Chapter 5, verse 20 says of us, in him, become the righteousness of God. Our verse, chapter 8, verse 9, says, you, through his poverty, become rich. That verse, chapter 5, uses spiritual language of sin and righteousness. This verse, chapter 8, uses material language of rich and poor. That verse, chapter 5, speaks of a unique salvation event. This verse, chapter 8, speaks of a pattern, a timeless model. And we're often comfortable with the unique and the spiritual and feel far more edgy when the gospel becomes a timeless model, a pattern for our love and what we do materially. What does love look like? Gospel generosity. And you see, Paul's language here gives us fresh perspectives on the wonders of the gospel. Though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor. I mean, think of it. For your sake, for our sake, he lost status. Because wealth brings status, it brings respect. It may be respect through gritted teeth, but if you're rich, you get respect, you get attention, you've got power. Poverty meant he was naked and humiliated. For your sake, for our sake, he lost security because wealth gives you protection and poverty leaves you vulnerable. Oh, he just had to say, and a legion of angels would rescue him. But he lands up nailed to a cross. For your sake, for our sake, he lost choices. I remember vividly someone saying he just experienced at least a fair share of wealth for the first time and people around him having it. And he said, I realize now, if you've got money, you always seem to have options. There's more than one way you can go wherever you're at. When you don't have it, you're just thankful if there's any road you can take out of here. Though he was rich, you know, up there with Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and Lakshmi Mittal, no, not up there with them, way above them on the rich list. Yet for your sake, he became poor. Didn't count equality with God a thing to be grasped, made himself a nobody. Humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross, naked, agonizing, shameful death. He was rich, he became poor, so that you, through his poverty, might become rich. You know, so that we can enjoy a status we don't deserve as children of God, or we can discover the security of adoption into God's family. We benefit from this extraordinary generosity, and the apostle tells us to show it to others. How do you test someone's love? It's not in the end, is it, by their talk? You know, I love you are three of the most wonderful words in the English language. They are also three of the most deceitful. And probably nearly all of us, to our shame, have used them both ways. But there are a number of things that show our character and expose it. And what we do with our money is one of them. You can tell someone's heart by how they spend their cash, by looking at the card statements. What does it mean to call ourselves Christian, to depend on God's extraordinary generosity and show none of it myself? We don't want our Christianity to mess with our wallets. My money's my own, we think. Well, Benjamin Warfield, a great American theologian of the past, took that one head on. He wrote this, Christ might have said, my blood is my own, my life is my own, then where should we have been? How can I call this Jesus my Savior, my Lord, and not show any of his generosity? What does love look like? Gospel generosity. How do you measure generosity? Well, that's an important question, isn't it? If generosity matters, what counts as generosity? Give me a figure. Although, of course, when it comes to talking about money, we do have a tendency to fudge. Some of it comes from a kind of biblical humility about not letting the left hand know what the right hand's doing, but I suspect that more of it comes from a kind of British embarrassment that insists we don't talk about money. But the Bible does. Rather a lot. And it doesn't hide behind ideas like it's the thought that counts. That's not really the language that's being used here, is it? I mean, look at verse 10. Here's my judgment about what's best for you in this matter. Last year, you were the first not only to give, but also to have the desire to do so. But now everything has stalled. So, verse 11, now finish the work so that your eager willingness to do it may be matched by your completion of it. See, there's a real desire, an eager willingness in the Corinthians. This isn't some dutiful counting out of whatever they've got in their pocket. You know, I suppose we ought, let's see what we can afford. It's not as if they've got an arm stuck halfway up their back. But Paul is looking for more than good intentions. You know, good intentions are not the same as gospel generosity. Because the gospel story goes far further than God looking down from his heaven and saying, oh dear, as the world turns sour. Or wouldn't it be nice if we could help out? I suppose I could, I'd love to. No, the gospel doesn't stop at I could, I'd love to. He did. Gospel generosity matches willingness with completion. Good intention with real giving. I came across this cartoon this week. You may not be able to see it that clearly, but the three figures as you go from left to right, the first one's headed mean, and the second one's headed mean to be generous. And it's only the third one that it gets to be generous. The cartoonist understands the kind of thing Paul's getting at here, doesn't he? The Corinthians meant to be generous a year ago. He's calling on them to be generous. So how do you measure generosity? Well, according to your means, he says. That's what Paul says at the end of verse 11. Giving is proportionate according to your means. For, verse 12, if the willingness is there, the gift is acceptable according to what one has, not according to what one does not have. That is why you can never tell how generous someone is just by the size of the check. It's why that rule of thumb that 80% of the giving is done by 20% of the people in churches may be statistically accurate, but it doesn't mean that those 20% are the generous ones. I got a letter this week from Crispin Odie. I never met him, never heard of him before, actually, but he seemed to know me. It was personally addressed to Hugh Palmer at my address. I opened it up, and I discovered that he heads Odie Wealth. It's obviously some investment management company, and they could do all kinds of wonderful things with my investment, as I read about it, and he would love to do it. He would love to have me as a client. And then I read the sentence which said that clients who have investable assets of £500,000 or more. I don't know what he imagines a Church of England clergyman is paid. But, you know, if I did qualify, and I had £500,000 lying around somewhere or other, and I wrote you a cheque for £10,000, you could easily imagine that I wouldn't miss it. As it is, if I do write you a cheque for £10,000, please be bowled over by my extraordinary generosity. So bowled over that I hope a bit of your mind is wary until you discover whether the cheque bounces or not. You know, and if it doesn't bounce, you probably need me checking for money laundering or something. You know, when are two 1p coins worth more than a £50 note? When they're all you've got. Remember Luke telling us about Jesus looking up and seeing the rich putting their gifts into the temple treasury, and he also saw a poor widow put in two very small copper coins. Treasurers, as you know, love silent offerings. Because notes and checks, you know, they make no noise, whatever container you're putting them in. To be honest, even credit cards and debit cards hardly make a sound should you want to throw yours in as well. But coins. And if it's going to have to be coins, the treasurer wants to hear that sort of significant clunk of a £1 or a £2 coin going in. The pathetic little clink, clink of one penny pieces. Oh, treasurers roll their eyes. I mean, it's hardly worth bothering to count them. Truly, I tell you, Jesus said, this poor widow has put in more than all the others. All these people gave their gifts out of their wealth, but she gave out of her poverty and put in all she had to live on. Now, giving is proportional according to our means, what we have. It's why 10% may be a good, even a stretching start point for our giving for many of us, but it might be a poor end point for some of us. And once he started talking like this, it's almost as if Paul knows where some of the thought patterns are going to go. And so you see, in verse 13, he picks up and just heads in a slightly different direction. Our desire, he says, is not that others might be relieved while you are hard-pressed. He's not trying to solve one problem over here by creating another one back there. You know, these folk aren't starving anymore. Yes, but you are. No. His aim is, verse 13, but that there might be equality. He repeats it again in verse 14. The goal is equality. The apostle is worried by inequality of wealth, which is a hugely contemporary problem, isn't it? The World Economic Forum has been concerned by it as well. At its meeting in Davos this week, by the way, that's an interesting choice of venue if you're concerned about inequality of wealth, isn't it? At its meeting in Davos this week, they heard that by next year, 1% of the world's population will own more of the world's wealth than the remaining 99% put together. I mean, that is quite staggering. 1% will own more than 50% of the world's wealth. I mean, in this country, at the general election, we must ask candidates, mustn't we? I mean, amongst the however many questions you've got for them, we must ask them this, how their party's austerity program, whatever it is going to fall fairly on rich as well as poor. And how, if the economic recovery continues, the fruit of it will be shared equally with poor as well as rich. But as Paul writes here, this is inequality within the Christian family he's talking about. Starving brothers and sisters in Jerusalem, comfortably off ones in Corinth. I heard Jean Vanier on the Today program last week. He's the founder of the L'Arche Communities. And he spoke about our fear of insecurities. That means we turn in on ourselves, hold on to what we've got. I think Paul can sense it here. Look at verse 14. At the present time, he says, your plenty will supply what they need. Yes, but where might that leave us? We have a fear of insecurities. And you know, if we give anything away, we're less protected against them, aren't they? At the present time, your plenty will supply what they need, so that in turn, there'll come a time, these things go in cycles, their plenty will supply what you need. The goal is equality. Less, I suspect, precise economic parity, you know, taking into account cost of living and so on. More the kind of equality that means we can still have fellowship together as brothers and sisters without being too embarrassed to visit other people's homes or have them to our home because the inequality is too great. Our World Mission Sunday gift day in a fortnight is a place where we contribute to restoring some equality in giving to partnerships and partnership projects around the world. Not in the sense of helping them over there, but in the sense of us together as the family of God. But actually, we contribute to the general fund here at All Souls with inequalities in mind as well. There are those of the church family that can't pay for the ministries they receive. Children, youth, students. They can contribute, they just can't sustain the cost of the ministries they're receiving now. The homeless, the trafficked, probably can't begin. But the day will come when many will get the job, earn the income. That means they can give to ministries in their local church that benefit others and not themselves. It's this kind of generous, according to your means giving, that means we'll have to let go of the idol of self-sufficiency. We'll have to discover the partnership of interdependence. The security, not of our wealth, but of the God who provided manna, bread in the wilderness for his people. That's what he's referring back to in verse 15. The one who gathered much didn't have too much. The one who gathered little didn't have too little. The God who can take care of his people, whether you come from a big family with many hands to gather or a small family with a few hands to gather, you won't have too much, you won't have too little. What does love look like? Gospel generosity. How do you measure generosity? According to your means. What does generosity require? I mean, if Paul is going to ask Corinthians to show this generosity, what should they be able to expect from him? Accountability. A proper care of and responsibility for gifts generously and sacrificially given. And these last verses in the chapter are full of Paul speaking and spelling out the steps he's taking. Look at verse 20. We want to avoid any criticism. Verse 21, we're taking pains to do what is right, not only in the eyes of the Lord, but also in the eyes of man. We not only want to do what's right, we want to be seen to be doing what's right. He understands how sensitive the whole money-giving area is. It's the same for us here at All Souls. If we ask you to give generously, you should expect us to show good practice in handling your gifts. Like Paul, he's got more than one person responsible. In our case, more than one person responsible at every stage, you know, for counting the money, for banking the money, for signing the checks. We'll have publicly audited accounts. We've got people who will check on expenditure to keep a tight rein on it. Paul isn't personally handling the money. I do not have any keys to the safe. No good asking me for it. But he ensures, like our finance team do, it's carefully, properly supervised. So he comes to the last verse in the chapter and he says to them, "Now prove your love. Therefore, show these men the proof of your love, the reason for our pride in you, so that the churches can see it." And there's the apostle's heart. When he talks about a test of your love, he's not like the grumpy teacher in a bad mood who says, "We're going to have a test this morning, just so I can show you how little work you've done and how much more you need to do." No, Paul is simply following through on what they had started. He longs to be able to point to the Corinthians, just as he had done with the Macedonians, as an example of a church that has passed this test of love with flying colors. And this series has got that heart too. Last week we began with a call, if you like, to a new generation, those who've joined us in the last 2 or 3 years, to give. But actually, every year means change for some. What we have alters. So what we gave is no longer necessarily a fair proportion. It may need to go down, it may need to come up. We're not really talking so much about take your card to the media centre, donate £1,000 today, though if you want to do that, we'd be very grateful. It's much more that we make sure giving is built into our discipleship. That's why we've talked a lot about standing orders. Because once you've filled them in, they keep turning good intentions into good practice. If you couldn't make it to the prayer gathering on Tuesday night, you missed something. We had with us Pastor Daniel from northeastern Nigeria, the part of Nigeria where the Boko Haram are at their most active and have caused devastation amongst churches and Christians there. He's personally been stoned. He's seen his church family. Some of them lose their lives for insisting on confessing Christ. He's seen his church congregation shrink as many have been killed and others have fled the area. He came to us last Sunday night. And he heard us pray, as we often do in our services, for the persecuted church. And it thrilled him in a kind of disproportionate way I've often found is true from people in that kind of a background. He said, "I'm so excited I'll be able to go home and tell my people that the church in Europe is praying for us." Well, we talked with him briefly on Tuesday night. And at the end, I just said to him, "How can we as a church encourage you? I mean, what can we do that will be of encouragement to your people and your church?" Not quite sure what sort of answer I expected him to give. Probably that we should pray for them, maybe even that we should give something to them. He didn't say all of that. He just looked at me and he said, "It's all in the Bible." I sort of thought, thank you, Daniel. He said, "It's all in the Bible." What he's really saying as he went on, he said, "Look, be the people the Bible wants you to be. That would be the biggest encouragement to me. Give money overseas?" Well, I'm sure he'd be thrilled. But actually, he'd seen last week's presentation about the opportunities and challenges we face in the next 5 years. If you missed it, I've outlined them briefly in the broadsheet here. He'd seen the opportunities and challenges ahead of us, and he was just as interested in us sustaining them and those ministries here. What would have thrilled him? What was going to encourage his people? Was for him to be able to say to them, "I went to All Souls and they love Jesus there. I went to All Souls and it's a gospel church." But of course, you can't love Jesus without showing his love. You can't be gospel church without showing gospel generosity. Prove your love. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you through his poverty might become rich. Well, the writer of our final hymn knew those words as well. It's a great way to end, to sing them to one another. Lord, you were rich beyond all splendor, yet for love's sake became so poor.